Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Beth Carver for the appellant L3. L3 brings this appeal from a judgment that included awards of 18 years lost profits on each of three separate causes of action brought by the plaintiff Sun Aviation against L3 for the termination of Sun as L3's distributor. Because there are a lot of parts to the judgment in this case, I want to make it clear from the outset the relief that L3 seeks here. First, L3 seeks outright reversal of the judgment against it on counts 1, 2, and 3 under the Power Equipment Act and the Inventory Repurchase Act because L3's products are not industrial maintenance and construction power equipment used in industrial maintenance and construction applications. Second, L3 seeks outright reversal of the judgment against it on count 4 for concealment because L3 did not have a duty to disclose to Sun its parent company's consolidation plans and the possibility that that might lead to Sun's termination. Third, L3 seeks reduction of the damage award entered in favor of Sun on count 1. So there were two damage awards on count 1. This one on the Franchise Act, the court awarded 18 years of lost profits on that for failure to give 90 days notice. So we ask that the damage award be reduced to the $19,134, which is the reasonable lost profits Sun would have earned over the 90-day notice period. If the court does not reverse the judgment against L3 on counts 1, 2, and 4, L3 requests in the alternative that the court reverse the damage award on those claims outright due to Sun's failure of proof or remand for a new trial on damages. And finally, L3 asks that the court enter judgment in its favor on its counterclaims because the undisputed evidence demonstrated that Sun never paid L3 the $278,000 for products that Sun ordered shortly before and mostly after its termination. The first claim on which Sun awarded L3 18 years of lost profits was its claims for improper termination without cause and improper and termination without notice under the Power Equipment Act. That's counts 1 and 2. The key question here is whether L3's products, its gyros and power supplies, are industrial maintenance and construction power equipment used for industrial maintenance and construction applications. That's the defining phrase in the Power Equipment Act. The definition that the trial court used in granting summary judgment to Sun was incredibly broad. First, the court ignored the industrial maintenance and construction language and simply added the combined the definitions of power and equipment and said that it covers every implement or article that uses or supplies energy and is used in an operation or activity. That definition covers every product with a motor, an engine, an electrical cord, and a battery. In reaching its conclusion that L3's products were covered by the Power Equipment Act, the court ignored the district court opinions in McBud and Generac, which are the only two opinions that have addressed the meaning of the defining phrase in the Power Equipment Act. The federal district court said in McBud that at minimum, power equipment must refer to end-use machines and equipment that operate and perform work using some power source or their own internal combustion engine. And McBud distinguished between such end-use equipment, which is covered by the Act, and component parts that work in an auxiliary or supplementary manner with other machines or equipment. Those are not covered by the Act. The Eighth Circuit affirmed McBud, and the Generac Court followed McBud's definition. And that definition meshes with a common understanding of what would constitute industrial power equipment, maintenance power equipment, and construction power equipment. Those phrases suggest heavy equipment such as graders, backhoes, tractors, forklifts. There may be smaller and lighter equipment that meet those criteria, but at a minimum, as Judge Shaw said, the power equipment means end-use equipment and not components. The court erred in holding that the gyros and power supplies are power equipment within the meaning of the Act. They're exactly what McBud said is not covered by the Act. They're components, and they work in an auxiliary and supplementary manner once they're installed in the aircraft. The gyros draw power from the aircraft's battery system. They're instruments that provide information to the pilot about the plane's position. They look like dials in the cockpit, just like the dials that we see in our car's dashboards. They last about 3 or 4 years, and they cost about $3,800. The power supplies are supplementary to the gyros and other instruments. They have to be fully charged before they're installed, and once they're installed, they must be continuously charged so that in the event of a power failure, They can provide backup power to one or two instruments, not the whole aircraft, just one or two instruments for about an hour. The trial court also erred in virtually ignoring the phrase maintenance or industrial maintenance and construction. It merely said that it is not disputed that these products are used in the avionics industry, which was presumably intended as a finding that the gyros and the power supplies were industrial equipment used in industrial applications. But that conclusion assumes that industrial power equipment means power equipment that's used in any industry at all, and ignores that industrial is at the very least ambiguous. This court said in the Keystone Laundry case that we discussed in our brief that references to a widespread type of business activity as an industry are of no consequence in determining the meaning of industrial plant. And the court concluded in that case that a commercial laundry was not an industrial plant because it neither manufactured nor processed anything by changing its characteristics or nature. The U.S. Supreme Court also recognized in the Decker case that industry and industrial can have different meanings. They can refer to business activity in general or economic activity concerned with processing of raw materials or the manufacturing of goods in factories. By interpreting industrial broadly to refer to any line of business, the trial court ignored the principle of statutory interpretation that every word in a statute must be given its own individual meaning to avoid rendering.
Does the meaning change by being used together, industrial maintenance and construction? Does that help us understand what was meant?
It absolutely does, Your Honor, because that's another statutory construction that nascitur associus, that words are known by the company they keep. Maintenance and construction are activities that change the nature or characteristics of something. Construction power equipment is used to turn raw materials into usually some kind of structure. Maintenance power equipment is used to either repair those structures or extend their useful life.
If we were to agree that it's ambiguous rather than unambiguous, as your opponent says, what then will we look to determine what meaning was intended?
I think, again, you look to the other words that are used in the statute, just as this court did in the Aquila case when they were deciding what processing meant. You looked at the statutory tax exemption and said that the other words in there were manufacturing, compounding, mining, producing. Those were words with industrial connotations. So here, industrial, it has that manufacturing, processing, producing type meaning. Otherwise, the legislature, you have to assume that the legislature used this broad, all-inclusive word industrial, and then two very specific words, maintenance and construction. And that is really an absurd result that the court tries to avoid in divining legislative intent.
And do we look at the context in which the word is used to determine whether it's ambiguous or unambiguous?
Yes, Your Honor, I think so. I mean, I think the court could approach it either way by saying that we know that industrial can be used broadly or narrowly, or you could say that it's based on the company it keeps in the statute and the purpose of the statute that it is unambiguous. The defining industrial to refer to manufacturing type activities also avoids giving the Power Equipment Act unintended breadth. The gyros and the power supplies that are at issue here are nothing like construction power equipment, graders, backhoes, forklifts, cranes. They're small things, relatively small things that are placed in an aircraft's cockpit and draw on that energy. Combined, the court's definition of power equipment and industrial result in the statute covering any product that's used in any industry that uses or supplies energy. That would cover most of the goods sold at a Home Depot or a Walmart. There's no reason to conclude that the court intended such an absurdly broad interpretation, especially when you look at what the Act does. It really removes the freedom of contract for manufacturers and suppliers. They can't negotiate the terms of their contract. It effectively creates perpetual distributorships, again, even for a Home Depot or a Walmart. There's no reasonable legislative purpose that would support such a broad construction. So we ask that the judgment on counts 1, 2, and 3 be reversed. The second claim on which the court awarded 18 years lost profits was Sun's concealment claim. The court gave two reasons why L3 supposedly had a duty to disclose to Sun its parent company's consolidation plans and the possibility that that might lead to Sun's termination. First, the court imposed the duty based on the testimony of L3's employee, Shelley Buckley, that it was fair, agreeing that it was fair to say that Sun had trust and confidence in L3. And second, the court imposed the duty based on L3's superior knowledge of its parent corporation's strategic plans. Neither of those reasons justifies imposing a duty to disclose on L3. First, Sun hasn't cited a case from Missouri or anywhere else that has imposed a duty to disclose just because one party in a commercial relationship has expressed trust and confidence in the other party to the relationship. In our opening brief, we identified a number of cases that say that's not enough, that mere trust and confidence between commercial entities does not impose a duty to disclose. Most, if not all, entities that transact business with each other have trust and confidence, or they wouldn't be doing business with each other.
Is it a question of what you have trust and confidence in, trust and confidence they'll do a good job versus trust and confidence they'll look out for you? We're very different things, aren't they?
Correct, Your Honor. And that this was just the bare statement in a deposition that they assumed that Sun had trust and confidence. And there are no other facts that put any meat on the bones to explain what the nature of that trust and confidence was. And that mere expression shouldn't be enough. It can't be enough to fundamentally alter the nature of their contractual relationship and impose new obligations.
Is it a subjective question or an objective question as to whether individuals feel trust and confidence or whether the nature of the relationship is such that there is a trust and confidence in that type of nature?
I think it has to be an objective test, Judge Breckenridge. The two restatement sections that the cases cite, Section 161 of the Second Restatement of Contracts and Section 551 of the Second Restatement of Torts, discuss the kinds of relationships that give confidential relationships that give rise to a duty to disclose. Priest, parishioner, lawyer, client, guardian, ward, those are relationships where one party has obligations to act in the best interests of the other. This was an arm's length in a business relationship in which both parties were acting in their own economic interests.
Thank you, Counselor. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor, Honors. Once again, I'm Mike Healy, and I have the privilege of representing the small Missouri business, Sun Aviation. Before jumping right into the legal issues, I had an introductory comment that I actually learned from attending the Missouri Bar Association convention and listening to the various judges talk about appeals and argument. And I found it very compelling, and it fits this case so well that I wanted to bring it up. And that is that the decision-making process of a judge, of a court of appeals, is just that. It's a process. It's a series of rules and guidelines that lead the court towards a result. It is not, as L3 has portrayed here, a result that you then cobble together the process. And that is exactly what is going on in this case. And here's what I mean by that. Beginning with the statutory issue on the Power Equipment Act, there's a process that has been outlined and is established in Missouri law that is time-tested and has been applied universally. When a statute is to be applied to a set of facts, the first thing you do is you look to the plain meaning of the language that the legislature chose, and you apply the plain meaning. If there's a term in there that is undefined, you look to the dictionary to determine what the definition is of that particular word. The third thing is you look to the purpose or the policy of the statute. What is this statute intending to cure? What is its point or purpose? Why did the legislature enact it? And you combine these things, and in this case, you take one further procedural step, which is to recognize that this is a public policy statute and consequently must be broadly, if not liberally, construed. In this instance, that is exactly what the trial court did. That is exactly what the unanimous Court of Appeals did. They applied this process, and that led them to the result that proved that these products are covered by this statute. Now, L3 will tell you that, wait a second, there is what they have termed an end-use requirement. That's, they've made two challenges to the statute, and so I have to confine my responses to the actual challenges that they've made on appeal rather than a wandering argument. And those two challenges are that the equipment must be end-use equipment and that it must be must process or manufacture something. So in addressing the first one, the end-use argument comes from the McBud of Missouri decision, which is a trial court decision out of the Eastern District Federal Court. But they have missed the point of McBud. The McBud case, as the court I'm sure is aware, involved switches and bus plugs and things that do not use power to perform any function. That was McBud. The commentary about the use of the equipment being auxiliary to other equipment was incidental to the opinion and the decision and was not discussed as a dispositive point in the decision. Again, the McBud decision hinged on the fact that the switches and the circuit breakers did not use power equipment.
So you're saying anything in the plane that uses power is industrial power equipment in the avionics industry?
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that...
What is your definition? I'm asking if that would come within that definition.
Yes. The definition of power equipment...
Industrial power equipment.
Right. When we look at it in the framework of the end-use argument by L3...
I understand. I'm asking what your definition is. I'm not talking about L3, what they say. What is your definition of industrial power equipment?
My definition is the same as the one in machine maintenance, which I really think is essentially the same one in McBud, which is a machine, a piece of equipment, must use or consume power.
So a light bulb in the plane would be industrial power equipment because it uses or consumes power? Or if not, where do we draw the line? Why would one be and the other not?
That's an outstanding question, and I think that's what L3 is trying to do. They're trying to push the line way down to achieve an absurd result. And that's not the case here. And the place that the two things that this court has to grapple with today are, number one, it doesn't have to decide exactly where that line is, but I would say two things. First of all, the equipment here is unquestionably sophisticated equipment. It has multiple parts. It does all kinds of things. It's self-contained, standalone, whole pieces of equipment, and all this is in the case. But secondly, when you look at where is, you know, what is an industry and what is included, the question for today is the avionics industry, is the aircraft...
But it's not an industry that's the thing. It's industrial equipment. Equipment is industrial modifies equipment, not the business that the equipment is used in. So is it industrial equipment?
Well...
Industrial power equipment.
Here's the reality of the matter, is that the legislature said equipment used in industrial applications. So it necessarily turns on the use of the equipment. And I think that down the road, in other circumstances, there might be an issue about whether or not is this piece of equipment used in an industry or is this more of a personal use? Is this a residential use?
It's a distributor of industrial maintenance and construction power equipment used for industrial maintenance and construction applications.
Exactly.
It could have just said light bulb. It could have just said battery. I mean, tell me, realistically looking at it, how are we to define this? If we accept your argument, we do have to look at where it will be applied. We can't just say we don't have to worry. We don't have to cover every situation, but we have to set a legal line that people can apply and understand in their business transactions and courts can.
Exactly.
What are you asking us to do?
And the line in this case is that you look at the product in this case, which is used exclusively in the aircraft industry. It is not a thing like a light bulb that could be used in all sorts of different places, whether it be in a textile plant or in your home bathroom. Okay.
Is something that's used in an aircraft used in the aircraft industry?
It would seem that way to me.
And what case law supports that?
There is a case called, and I'm going to butcher the name just a little bit, it's Balloons Over the Rainbow or Rainbow Over the Balloons that I cited, something like that that's in my case. And that was a tax case question that it talked about, actually a hot air balloon, and there was a part that was in hot air balloon that was discussed. But the important thing is, in this case, are the uncontroverted, undisputed admissions of the defendant that its products were used in the aircraft industry, the aviation industry. It is not disputing that. There is no question. Your light bulb scenario, there could very well be a question, you know.
But that's used in the airplane. I mean, that can't be what it means. We agree that's absurd, but I'm not understanding then how I make that distinction that you're asking us to make. I want your help in understanding.
Sure. And the analogy that comes to mind, Judge, is that when you look at use restrictions that are passed by various, you know, municipalities or homeowners associations or whatever, they turn on what are you using this for? It's not so matter what is it, it's what are you using this for? And that's a fact-driven question. And in this case, there's only but one use. I do think that this is going to be somewhat of a case-by-case analysis because, and again, I'll go back to your light bulb. A light bulb could be used in a variety of contexts, but it's the use. In this case, wherever that line might be, whatever the court might decide as somewhere in between light bulbs and sophisticated avionics, there's one question that is clear in this case, and that is it was used in industry, in the airplane, in the aircraft industry, and it's admitted in this instance.
And going back to my question, so if I own an automobile and I buy a part for my automobile, under your definition, that would be a part used in the automobile industry.
Well, the automobile industry, you know, if you buy an engine for your car, okay, and there are manufacturers, Rolls-Royce, there's Cummins, there's all kinds of different companies that build engines, and if you buy that engine and it goes into your car, then it would seem to me that is built into, you know, it's used in the context of the automotive industry. The aircraft industry is so clear because airplanes are used for commercial and industrial purposes. There's no crossover between residential, personal, or homeowner use. And that's what L3 is wanting to say, is that this is going to be some massive, broad, sweeping deal where distributors of watches and hair dryers and copper wiring are included within the protections of the statutes. And that's just not so. That's just not so, because you know, the case that I quite frankly like, and I know it's a tax exemption case, it doesn't have a lot to do with these statutes, it's strictly construed, which is the opposite of here, but it's that Lincoln Industries case where this court came out and said, look it. And I think that I've almost got the closing remark memorized, and it's something to the effect of the dictionary does not distinguish between simple and complex machinery. The legislature and statute does not distinguish between simple and complex.
Well, it actually does. It says industrial maintenance and construction power equipment. So it's listing a specific type of equipment, and it's distinguishing between that and other kinds. What does industrial mean? In one of our earlier cases, we said you do look at, it was the Aquila or one of the other ones where we talked about cooking you could describe as processing, but no one does describe it as that way. And talking about processing, manufacturing, and other terms like that, we said suggest industrial connotations. And cooking is just cooking. And even though you can make those words fit parts of it, that's not what it means in people's understanding. The opposing counsel says that analysis applies here. A battery and a gyro simply is not industrial equipment as that term would be used. You think it is industrial equipment. Again, help the court. Why is your understanding better?
Sure. And two parts to that. The first one I want to say is that a power supply is not a battery. Okay? It provides power, but it's vastly more complicated than that, as explained in my brief. It does all sorts of things to make sure that it supplies power in an emergency. So it's not a battery. It's not something. It's not an ever-ready battery that you put in your flashlight. It's way, way, way more than that. Secondly, with regard to the industry issue, again, industrial equipment is used in an industry, and industries use industrial equipment. In this case, it is undisputed and admitted that the aircraft industry, the aviation industry, is in fact an industry, and it is admitted that this is where this equipment is used. It is not like a microwave that the Casey's gas station or grocery store is using to heat up pizza that can be moved around in all different contexts. And I'm familiar with the court's decision in Aquila, and I'm also familiar with all the decisions that the court has written about the integrated plant document and how I believe it's the Floyd decision that completely rejects the notion that L3 is promoting here, that it must be raw materials transformed into finished goods. That's just simply not it doesn't even apply in the tax cases, let alone in this case where we're dealing with a remedial statute based upon public policy.
I don't want you not to get a chance to address the trust and confidence issue, and I also want you to address the issue of why you disagree with the argument that the Franchise Act just gives damages that occurred from the lack of notice for 90 days as opposed to the 18 years of damages that you got under that.
Certainly. I will move on to those exact questions. I do want to conclude the Power Equipment Act commentary with one conclusion, and that is the legislature did write a broad statute to cover the nature of equipment, but then they reined it in significantly by making the requirement of good cause so broad. Only in the entire history of the good cause requirement, there's only been 13 cases. Because good cause is so broad, and because, as the amicus Mid-Continent Equipment points out, that and Mid-Continent sells these same types of things, and they agree. And so I think the court should take particular note of the Mid-Continent amicus brief. They agree that application of this statute to this instance stabilizes the market, promotes Missouri business, and is consistent with the legislature. They say that in fashioning the terms of the contract, the manufacturer has the ability to narrow in the scope of what might constitute good cause. So at first blush, you think, oh my gosh, it's this huge statute, but in fact, it's very small.
You have 30 seconds.
I know. I'll go real fast. Trust and confidence in this particular, trust and confidence and superior knowledge are the two requirements that this court has applied universally. In this particular instance, the testimony of Shelley Buckley, uncontroverted, repeated.
But can you address opposing counsel's point that this court has said, and pretty much all courts say, every relationship you're not allowed to propose trust and confidence, and I think landlord-tenant, we've said that's not the kind of industry or business in which you can repose trust and confidence. Of course, you do with lawyers and doctors and so forth, but there's certain kinds of relationships that can be fiduciary or confidential and certain that can't. And why and an arm's-length business transaction is always put in the other camp. What can that statement take it out of it and put it? Is that statement sufficient to show a personal trust and confidence that person's looking out for you, as opposed to and therefore bring it in as an exception to the normal rule that a business transaction does not qualify?
Business in this particular case, the evidence is, and I'm out of time, but I'll keep answering them until you throw me out. in this particular instance, the characterization of the nature of the relationship was a partnership. That's how L3 described it. They said that they knew and understood that Sun Aviation reposed trust and confidence in them. They were and
trust and confidence as to what, to look out for them, or that they knew their business, or what?
Trust and confidence in the nature of the number one most important thing to any distributor, which is termination of its largest supplier, a death shot to the distributor. The trust and confidence that if something like that is coming around the bend, that they would go to that distributor and say, hey, you know what, we're getting ready to wipe you out.
Counselor, you're out of time. We'll make sure and review your arguments presented in your brief, as we already
have. Thank you, Judge. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Counsel.
Your Honor, we agree that you can look at the statute and the plain meaning of the words in the statute, but you can't just look at power equipment in a vacuum. The whole phrase is industrial maintenance and construction power equipment, and the industrial construction and maintenance language orients you to the kind of power equipment that's at issue in the statute. Counsel for Sun said that there's a broad public policy to be enforced here, and so there, you know, should be given a broad reading to the statute. But what is the public policy that could be served by defining industrial to mean power equipment used in any industry? I mean, it's you've got all these other, counsel's brief goes through all the other kinds of good cause statutes, as they call it, and they're ATVs, RVs, motorcycles, watercraft, they're all big, heavy equipment, and they're very specific. Maintenance and construction are very specific, too. And I think the affidavits in the McBud case, I know that the court is very wary of using legislative affidavits to divine the intent of a statute, but there are affidavits that the court discusses in McBud from non-legislators, the trade group people, who say power equipment has a recognized, accepted meaning in the industry, and they used industrial maintenance and construction because it covers the waterfront of, you know, there's a lot of cross usage. You could use a crane in maintenance or in construction, but by using those three words, they covered all the kinds of heavy equipment that are self-propelled and self-powered.
Counsel, does trust and confidence rise to the same level as a fiduciary relationship, or is it something less?
I think the way that the restatement sections discuss, and I think the way the court has discussed it, it's fiduciary-like. I wouldn't even say fiduciary-like. I mean, it's got to be very close to a fiduciary relationship. The Andes case that we cite that this court decided, which had to do with a woman who sued her ex-husband's lawyer, at one point they call it relationship of trust and confidence, but then when they're deciding there is no duty to disclose, they say there was no fiduciary duty. So I think it's got to be of that nature, and the nature of a fiduciary relationship and of a confidential relationship is basically where you are placing the interests of another entity or another party or another person above your own. And this was arm's length. Counsel also stated that the Generac case he liked the Generac case because that was the language that he liked. It followed McBud. If you read Judge Hamilton's opinion very carefully, there are two cases. She first said that the Generac, and it was first a motion to dismiss, and then I'm sorry, I'm out of my time. But
thank you, Counselor.
Thank you, Counselor. Judge.